everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens presented by TheAthletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Godin alongside Arpin Basu. Arpin, what a snowy day.
Snowy day, schools are closed, but the Canadiens are practicing.
Yeah, I know.
Because they got to practice.
I know. And we're skipping practice
today. We're skipping practice today record this pod and talk to all of you.
That's it.
My loyal listeners.
So we're Friday, February 7th. Listen, we discussed many topics that we could, bring forward today. Importance of, the impact of sending Jesperi Kotkaniemi to Laval, what's going on in Trois-Rivières in the CHL thing. But ultimately, let's talk about trade deadline. Because, that's a fun issue, and that's a complicated issue. It's really, I remember you wrote on The Athletic 2 or 3 weeks ago that the coming trade deadline would probably be the most difficult that Marc Bergevin has ever faced. And as we head towards that deadline, I think that it's more and more true.
Yeah, it's the second year in a row, actually, he's facing his most complicated trade deadline. But this year, compared to last year, is far different in the sense. And we got kind of a tell of what Marc Bergevin is thinking might be going into this year's deadline. Last year, when he kind of refused to spend anything to improve that team, which had obviously a far more legitimate chance, sitting in a playoff spot at the trade deadline. He did make improvements, and those improvements actually turned out to be pretty shrewd acquisitions, but they were little nibbles around the edges, and he didn't spend anything really to get those guys. We're talking about Nate Thompson, Jordan Wheel, and Christian Follin, by and large. Dale Weiss was acquired too, but I don't think he was a priority really. But
no,
he got Nate Thompson, Jordan Wheel, and Follin for basically nothing.
Nothing.
I mean, Nate Thompson cost him 19 spots in the draft. It was really... He moved down 19 spots from late 4th to early 5th. So that's...
Right.
And Wheel was for Michael Chaput.
Yeah, and Follin and Weiss came in a trade for David Schlemko, who's out of hockey right now.
Yeah, so his refusal to sort of invest in that team is the way I kind of looked at it. He chose not to invest prime assets in that team... that was competing for a playoff spot legitimately, and probably I would say chances were pretty decent might have made it had he made a bigger acquisition, a bit more of a scoring presence or an extra defenseman who could actually legitimately play in his top four. Might have been the difference between them not making it and making it. But
I remember we discussed guys like Marcus Johansson.
Yeah.
Or even,
the price paid for Marcus Johansson was a joke. It was a third round pick. I mean, so right. it was nonsensical not to do that. My understanding was that when the Canadians checked on Johansson, that was not the price. The Bruins, took advantage of a sort of a Thomas Vanek situation,
right,
where they slipped in at the last minute and the price came down. I think at that price, the Canadiens probably would have done it. But in any case, that was not the price. I can only presume it was a second-round pick up until right before the deadline. What makes this one more complicated than last year is that, A, there's many reasons. One is that the Canadiens are not competing for a playoff spot, so there's no real legitimate reason to buy. However, I think we're going to discuss a scenario through which they might buy.
Yeah.
And B, that they have all these guys heading towards the final year of their contract, their entire first line, who is now their number one defenseman in the absence of Shea Weber, and
Kovalchuk.
And then there's the Kovalchuk situation that has also become more complicated. I turned to you, I think, last night during the Ducks game, and Kovalchuk was really motivated. His family was in the building, and so it's... Did they make it to that game?
Yes, they did.
Yes, so I think it was quite apparent that Kovalchuk was had a little extra kick in his step, knowing that his kids were in the building. So he has started to change my mind on his whole status on the team, where I'm starting to think that maybe he's maybe getting a third round pick for him isn't all that valuable compared to what he could bring you for 1 year. But that's a complicated situation because I'm not fully sold on that yet. So all these, there's all these things, these really complex files that Bergevin needs to make sense of between now and February 24th. So I would like to start. Why don't we start with Kovalchuk?
Where we were. So Kovalchuk, it is a complex situation for two reasons. First, you mentioned his family. He's got four kids. His oldest daughter is in high school. She's going to stay in California for the remainder of her high school years. So presumably the whole family will stay there. So I think that if he wants to re-sign in Montreal, he's going to be away from his family, which is I think at this point in his career and with the previous choices that he's made would not really be in sync with what he's done in the past. So it's all speculation on my part, but I think that really that's the sort of thing that really plays a role. Now, Kovalchuk likes it in Montreal. I think that it's become clear, but there's a reason why he likes it so much. It's because the Canadians have given him an environment inside which he could still be a relevant player in this league. There are not that many teams that were in a position to say, well, listen, Ilya, we're going to sign you to a contract and we're going to give you a top six role and you're going to play on our power play. So the Canadians were in that situation, and Kovalchuk, to be effective and to give you all that he can give you, even at this later stage in his career, he's got to be given an important role. And so the Canadians were able to provide that, and presumably they would still be able to do that next season. But they have to choose based on a sample size that's still rather small. I mean, he's played 13 games for the Canadians. Most of them, I would say 9 of those 13 were really, really good games. But it's still a small sample, and it would be risky to say, you know, it's okay for the town to fall in love with Kovalchuk, but it's a riskier proposition when it's the GM that falls in love with the player. So based on those 13 games, are you going to say, well, we're ready to sign him to another contract? The flip side of it is that if the Canadians say, well, we don't have what we want on the trade market, if all we can get is a third round pick, well, that third round pick is not going to get anything for us, anything done for us next season. And if we think that Kovalchuk is able to score 15, 18 goals, well, that third round pick is not going to be there to provide those goals if we trade Kovalchuk. Right. So I think that's what has been put in the balance now in something that originally seemed like a very obvious decision to make, which was let's just trade Kovalchuk for the best asset possible, because after all, in that situation, Bergevin is playing with house money.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, totally. It's not even house money; it's found money. It's like it's literally like he found $100 sitting on the street and he picked it up and he spent it.
Yeah.
So that's, and he winds up with this guy. You know, the sample size thing is interesting to me because he actually played his 14th game last night.
14th.
Yeah. On Thursday night, and he has 11 points in 14 games.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the thing about LA that I find strange is he played 17 games in LA and had 9 points. So it's not as if he was this total black hole of production, but he just fell out of favor. He fell out of favor with the coaching staff there, and it became untenable. And the main number in LA is his 15-25 of average ice time,
mm-hmm.
compared to the 19-23 he's getting in Montreal.
Big difference.
Yeah. So, and you know, you had an excellent quote in your feature on Ilya Kovalchuk from Ray Ferraro, who played with Kovalchuk his rookie season in Atlanta, and mentioning his need to feel important. Like it's not even a matter of ice time. It's a matter of leveraged ice time. It's a matter of important moments in the game. So you can play him 16 minutes, but when you need a goal, you better throw him on the ice. You can't have him sitting on the bench when you're down a goal with 3 minutes left. Like, that's when he wants to be in the game, you know?
He's been like that his whole career, though. His whole time in Atlanta, he was constantly the go-to guy. I mean, Heatley was there for a while. Then it was Marian Alsa. But he was the guy that the team looked upon to score a key goal. He was traded to the New Jersey Devils. Same thing. He was used close to 30 minutes a night on some occasions by Jacques Lemaire and by Peter DeBoer. He was looked upon for offense. He's always been the go-to guy. So that's why it clashed so much when he arrived in L.A. because they thought, okay, well, now here's a guy who's getting older. He's not what he used to be. He's going to be like a complementary part. And for him, it's even though he might not, he obviously doesn't have like his, he's past his prime. He still has this mindset that I'm meant to be a part of the solution.
Right, and not only that, but he was in a situation in LA where it'd be difficult for him to justify in his mind playing a lesser role on a team like that, a team starved for goals, a team without a whole lot of talent up front who could produce on a regular basis. I mean, it's, you know, it reminds me of kind of Lars Eller's situation here, where, you know, when he was here, I think there was always in the back of his mind, he believed that he should be in the top six, that he would be a better center for Pacioretty than Desharnais. And there were, it was justifiable in his mind to say, I could play Desharnais' role better than Desharnais. Mm-hmm. And maybe he wasn't wrong. But anyhow, it just didn't happen. And he constantly had that in his mind. Whereas he went to Washington, there was no way he could make that argument because he's playing behind Kuznetsov and Backstrom and he's perfectly fine with it. And I see kind of Kovalchuk in a similar situation in the sense where in LA, maybe he felt, okay, I'm not getting minutes, but why am I not getting minutes? Who's getting those minutes instead of me? And how could any sane person...
Tyler Toffoli?
Yeah, how could any sane person argue that this is, in fact, how it should be? I'm not saying it's that different in Montreal. And for the meantime, he's been getting those minutes. But I feel like in a fully healthy Canadiens lineup, let's say, and with young players, talented players, you know, a Jonathan Drouin, you know, if Max Domi ever learns again how to play on the wing of Max Domi. And, you know, I mean, if he sees productive players playing ahead of him, I think he'd have less of a problem taking a lesser role.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he still want to be important. He'd have to be on the power play, which if you have Ilya Kovalchuk on your team, why would you not play him on the power play? No matter who you have on your team, really, he's...
Yeah, and I don't know why they put him at the point. Honestly, they're wasting his shot when they use him.
I don't understand that either, but, you know, we could do a whole podcast on their power play and questionable decisions on it. But at least he's on there, and he's usually on that left circle, which is where he's, you know, against Anaheim he was on the point, and it made no sense. He became a distributor. But it's really, to me, a question of being on a winning team. And the one thing that strikes me and the one thing he's been really consistent on and appears sincere about, because a lot of people are going to say, oh, what else is he going to say? He's on the team. But like he speaks with a sincerity when he talks about the young players on this team. He talks about the direction the team's going in, playing in front of Price, playing with Weber. I mean, it really does seem there is a certain appreciation there that they gave him this opportunity and that he would be willing to extend it, and that it's not completely out of the question that this team could compete for God knows what next year, but he seems to believe in the direction of the team. So, you know, I've been staunchly, staunchly against keeping Ilya Kovalchuk past the trade deadline under any circumstances. Like, I have, from day one, and I'm still not completely off that, but I have to admit that last night, as I mentioned, I turned to you and I'm like, he might be changing my mind.
Yeah.
Like, but the sample size issue is real. Keep in mind, not only has he only played 14 games for the Canadiens, he's had a bye week thrown in.
Yeah.
And he had 2 months off before that. So he's had a lot of rest. We don't know what he would look like in an 82 season grind. Last year, he played 64 games for the Kings. Got 34 points, you know, decent production. But, you know, we haven't seen him play an 82-game season ever, really. The last time he played an 82-game season was in 2007. So it's, you know, he came pretty close in New Jersey once. He played 81. But so these are all legitimate questions. But if he is just sort of additional scoring depth and they could potentially load manage him a bit next season, then who knows? Maybe, but the jump is there, and the enthusiasm for for the game is evidently there. The guy loves playing hockey. He loves to score goals. It's an infectious kind of thing that he has going on.
Yeah, and the other thing that that bears notice when it comes to Kovalchuk is that he loves playing in a market that loves hockey. He loves the spotlight, and it's a sort of environment that is kind of new to him, because even though he told me that LA was somewhat of a underestimated market for hockey, because the fan base, even though it's not as large as in Canadian markets, it's they're there and they're loyal. But he said it's an entirely different thing in Montreal, and he likes it. And I'll share an anecdote that's in my in the piece that I wrote, revisiting the efforts made in 2001 by then GM André Savard, who tried to acquire the first pick overall from the Atlanta Thrashers in order to draft Kovalchuk and bring some excitement and entertaining player for the masses while the team was a bottom feeder.
Right.
So in that piece, Don Waddell told me that he used to bring former Canadiens great Boom Boom Geoffrion in the locker room before the beginning of every season. So Boom Boom used to live in Atlanta in the later stages of his life. So he was there. He was hanging around the Thrashers. And so he would go and talk to the Thrasher players, once a year. The year that Kovalchuk was drafted, so 2001, when he first arrived in the locker room and he saw Boom Boom, Don Waddell told me that his eyes lit up so much that he's never forgotten the look on Kovalchuk's face. And he said what was so incredible is that here was a kid that was coming from Russia, who was not necessarily in constant contact with the NHL, some other Russian players sometimes are not as connected, or even European players are not necessarily heavily connected with the NHL. And a lot of the North American players on the Thrashers did not know who Geoffrion was. And yet Kovalchuk knew exactly who he was. So he's got this sense of history of the amplitude of things, of hockey-related things. And I think that speaks volume to a guy that can really appreciate what it is to play Montreal.
Yeah. Just going to take a quick break off that, because I want to remind our listeners, the story that Marc-Antoine just referenced was an excellent story, a sort of what-if about what would have happened had the Canadians had that pick. How might things have changed had Ilya Kovalchuk become a Canadian in 2001? Spoke to André Savard. Don Waddell is an excellent feature. If you want to read stuff like that and are not subscribed to The Athletic yet, you can get a discounted subscription. All Athletic Support listeners are free to subscribe using this link, theathletic.com/athleticsupport. We'll get you 40% off your first year subscription. So I encourage, if you want to read excellent work like the story that Marc-Antoine just referenced that he wrote and ran just on Tuesday, or any of the other things that we write on a daily basis, not only on the Canadiens, but on every single team in the NHL, every team in Major League Baseball, every team in the NFL, NBA, English Premiership, you name it, we cover it. You can get all of that at a 40% discount at theathletic.com/athletic support.
Awesome. So that being said, so we talk about the reasons why Kovalchuk could stay Montreal. Now, trade deadline is coming up. What do you think? Who could be interested in Kovalchuk, and what the Canadiens could get for him?
Well, I'm no insider, but I rely on our resident insider Pierre LeBrun, who really canvasses the league. Unlike any other, really, he talks to a lot of people, and other guys are reporting that the idea of getting a second round pick for Kovalchuk just does not appear realistic, and that apparently a second round pick appears to be the minimum that Marc Bergevin would need to move him. So this is obviously posturing. There's a lot of this that goes on at this time of year, about 3 weeks before the deadline. Teams that are selling players make it seem like they're considering keeping them. It happens every year. Teams that are buying players make it clear they're not going to part with their first round pick or even their second round pick for player X. And then they do. Happens every year. So I am of the mind that, you know, I thought when I initially saw Pierre's report that Bergevin is looking at nothing less than a second round pick, I was like, that's insane. Mm. That was my first reaction, was this is crazy. How could you honestly think that you would not trade this found money for a third round pick? It just makes no sense, because that would be a found third round pick. And frankly, who would say no to just a free third round pick? Here.
Right.
Take a third round pick for nothing. That would be the equivalent. But again, he's changing my mind. And based on everything we just talked about, maybe it's not worth getting a third round pick. But right now, it seems like that is what he would get. And not only would it be a third round pick, it would likely be a late third round pick. So we're talking about a pick somewhere around, what? My math is failing me here.
Well, around 90.
90. Yeah. 90th overall pick. You know, what are the chances of a 90th overall pick ever playing for the Canadiens?
Well, you know, he
pretty could, slim. But
between 80 and 90, isn't that the window in which Matthias Norlander was traded? Was drafted something? Because he ended up being a third round pick, but it was earlier in that round.
Yeah,
but in any case, yeah, I get your point. I think, but at the same time, I mean, there are so many, financially speaking, the fact that he makes only $700,000 and prorated at the trade deadline. I think a team only needs something like $150,000.
It's not a factor.
It's not a, so the fact that everybody can afford to get him, it should stimulate, you know, the proposals, because it's not as if you got only two or three teams that are fighting for his services. You've got, you know, anybody, even teams that are really stacked against the salary cap. They can still say, at least if we want to get it, we want to improve, we've got this guy there.
I mean, I'll say one thing. There were several scouts at the game against the Ducks that I don't recognize, that I didn't recognize, that are not often at Canadiens games. You know, a lot of people like tweet out who the scouts are at certain games, and scouts from this team. What I think a lot of fans don't realize is that a lot of these scouts are just based in certain cities, and they're often at the same rink all the time. So, like, you know, for instance, the Dallas Stars have a scout who's based in the area and is almost at almost every game. Doesn't mean the Stars are scouting the Canadiens necessarily.
Chicago's got two.
You know, Pierre Gauthier's at like every game. The Blackhawks are not. He's their director of player personnel. He's not scouting the Canadiens per se. He's scouting hockey games. He's there to watch hockey, which is what these guys do. So having said that, and, you know, there's a few others, the Maple Leafs. There's like six or seven teams that have scouts who are regularly at the Bell Center. And so when seeing them, it's not out of the ordinary. It's when people show up that you don't usually see where you start to be like, oh, look, there's people here.
Yeah.
And last night, walking along Scouts Row, that struck me. There were a lot of unfamiliar faces there. And so I don't know if they were there to watch Kovalchuk. I don't know what they were there to watch. It's very possible they were there to watch the Ducks, because they're clearly going to be a selling team. So don't read too much into it, but I will just say that with the performance that Kovalchuk put on in front of these new eyes, you know, it's as he continues to expand the sample size of games he's playing with the Canadiens, the chances of the Canadiens getting something of real value for him, you know, aka a second round pick, grows in tiny incremental ways as he continues to prove himself game after game.
Someone told me last night that the issue with Kovalchuk is not a financial issue, is the fact that he's, you know, he's a very friendly guy. All his teammates love him. He's liked throughout the league. But he's also a guy that plays a little bit his own way, and he likes things done a certain way. And in order to making sure that he's going to buy in into the team concept, you need to have a team that's got a strong leadership. So some teams are better equipped than others in having that nucleus that could absorb a guy like Kovalchuk and say, hey, you know what, things are going a certain way here. come and join the party. So that's why, even though there could be a ton of buyers from a financial standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, there's not that many where you say, okay, well, because a team like Pittsburgh, for example, is a good example of a team where that could integrate a guy like Kovalchuk and say, well, we've got a strong leadership. We've got the Penguins way that's been long established. And if you want to be a part of it, come on. It hasn't worked for everybody. It hasn't worked for David Perron. It didn't really work for Jerome Iginla. But for others, it did. Boston's another one that comes to mind. And they've got a good tradition of bringing those older players.
Jager. Like Iginla,
Jager, Recchi. Mm-hmm. So I could see Kovalchuk going there. And you know what? They had a guy named... Carson Kuhlman, who was playing on the second line. They've got a spot open on the wing if they want.
Oh, no. The Bruins need a top six winger. This is clear.
If they want to be three lines deep, that's...
Yeah, and that's why they were the team that was most rumored to be... to be after Kovalchuk before, when he was terminated by the Kings. That apparently never went anywhere. That was mostly rumor. But, I agree with you. Those two situations would be cool fits. Edmonton.
Yeah.
Team that needs a winger.
Right.
They don't have the same leadership dynamic in Edmonton, but they do have the best player in the world. And I think there would be a certain level of deference on Kovalchuk's part to playing with the consensus best player in the world. I mean, I don't think he'd be stepping on Connor McDavid's toes if he played there. And so, like, there are situations around the league. There's so many teams apparently looking for wingers, and this is actually a good way to kind of segue into our second sort of trade deadline category. But Kovalchuk is the easiest fix for those teams and a great plan B for those teams. I'm sure there are other targets that those teams have, but a guy who takes up no room on the cap, who has proven not only throughout his career but this season with Montreal that he could produce in a good situation, and a guy that has been universally loved by the Canadians. So I mean, the fit issue doesn't seem to be one for him. So are they willing to spend a second round pick on a player they could have had for nothing? That's what it might come down to. It's a silly argument to make, but it might come down to that, where they just swallow their pride and say, like, listen, we screwed up, we let this guy go to Montreal, but now we need him.
Yeah,
we're going to use a second round pick to get him.
There's one team, the Vegas Golden Knights, that are really, they're in a good situation when it comes to picks, because they've got two second round picks for the upcoming draft. They've got two third round picks also. And they've got two second-round picks for the draft in 2021. So this is the sort of team that, if they're remotely interested in Kovalchuk, that could help the Canadians driving the prices up.
Yes. Now, these teams, it should be said, would probably want someone like Tomáš Tatar first, because he's got a year left on his deal. This is the complicated stuff that we were talking about with Mark Bergevin. It's that he wants to compete next year. He's got these two guys. Let's talk about these two guys, because Tomáš Tatar has not officially been put on the market, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But the more people talk about him, the more I'm sure Bergevin is fielding calls about him. This is one reality of this business, is that, you can write speculative pieces on players, but GMs get wind of those stories and they make calls based on them. It's a fact. It is what happens.
It used to surprise me that these things happen, but
they do.
They do.
They absolutely do. So, it's a legitimate question to say, what do you do with Tomáš Tatar? Because he is the oldest of the group of forwards. He's the oldest player on his line, all of whom have contracts that expire in 2021. If he were to re-sign, his new contract would kick in after he's 30. So you'd be signing him from age 30 to 35, let's say.
Yeah.
Something in that 34 to 36. And is that really the smart thing to do for this guy? Or is it smarter to sort of cash your chips and get what you can for him when his price is very, very high? When you're offering a team two playoff runs a whole season next year, and he's been one of the most consistent producers, frankly, in the league at his level. You know, if you want a guy who scores somewhere between 23 and 26 goals, he will deliver, almost guaranteed.
Yeah.
It's that's a valuable piece. And not so only,
and he makes $4.8 million a year. Well, the Canadians pay him $4.8 million a year. And the Canadians have so much room under the cap that he could also retain some of that salary, which makes him even more interesting because the Canadians can retain salary at the end of this season and for next season also. This is the window in which they're still got wiggle room money-wise. So it could further enhance his value if the Canadians were to retain 40 or 50% of his salary.
Exactly. So do you do it? Because here's the tricky part, is that he's an important part of one of the top lines in hockey, one of the top 5-on-5 lines in hockey. It's one of the 10 best.
Yeah.
And that's being conservative, I feel. He's a big part of the identity of that team in the sense of how his motor and the fact that he never stops skating and he's a relentless forechecker, creates tons of turnovers in the neutral zone. Everything the Canadians hope to accomplish when they don't have the puck is what Thomas Tatar generally does and does very well. He's one of the best finishers on the team. Which is something the Canadians are not exactly swimming in, is strong finishers. So,
and he's playing the best hockey in his career since he's arrived in Montreal.
Yes, exactly. So does this sound like the guy that you should trade when you are quite clearly disappointed with how this season went, expected to make the playoffs or at least hope to make the playoffs, but definitely expected to be in the mix for a playoff spot this season. But definitely there's a definite expectation that this team be in the playoffs next season. I don't think that should be understated in any way. I don't think that's an overstatement at all. I think the Canadians fully expect this team to be a solid playoff team next year. And so, again, the same argument that we were mentioning with Kovalchuk, you know, do you take the 15 to 18 goals you think Kovalchuk could get you? Or is the third round pick, does that offset that in a proper way? And this is the same thing. And you know, I think the Canadians would only listen on Thomas Tatar if a first-round pick was in play and a close-to-the-NHL, legitimate, strong prospect was involved. A player who could conceivably make the team next year. So at that point, how do you tackle that?
Yeah, so I think that if the Canadians say, well, our biggest effort will be to re-sign all of our guys that we consider good and keep our core intact, they're going to spend more money to have a team that's probably not good enough, even though if everybody is healthy, if you have an injury-free season, it can reasonably be a playoff team. In my mind, it comes down to Tatar versus Max Domi. Because I think that in the long run, Philippe Danault is going to be re-signed by the Montreal Canadiens. I'm pretty sure of that. They value him. He's everything that they're looking for in a centerman. If the price is decent, they'll want to keep him. So in the long run, you'll have Danault, you'll have Nick Suzuki, and Jesperi Kotkaniemi. That's your center line. They've already started thinking in the long run, saying, how can we fit Ryan Poehling into the top nine in the foreseeable future? And the best way to do it is by putting in the wing. Max Domi, I think that his future in Montreal is tied to becoming a winger. So at this point, will they choose to keep Max Domi as a winger and pay him accordingly? Because this contract is up this summer. Or are they going to choose to keep Tatar and signing to a new contract? I don't think that they can do both, because otherwise they're going to lock themselves up with a lot of money with no possibility to improve themselves. They have to use one of those two assets to either get some help on defense or get some futures, whether it's an established A prospect or draft picks or whatever. I used to think that Tatar was the obvious candidate, the clearest candidate to be traded, the most logical choice. But with Domi having a hard time settling in at the wing, and he's always brought back to center, and now he's being helped by the fact that Kotkaniemi's been sent to Laval. If he doesn't prove able to make that switch to the wing and be like a key player on the top six as a winger, well, then he has to be the guy that you trade. You could trade both, but if you choose to keep both next season, it'll mean that all the eggs are in the basket for making the playoffs next season, and your arguments about being looking at the long term, well, you can throw that out the window.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's the Domi thing is a problem, frankly, because this just adds on to the other problems that Domi has presented, his lack of discipline at times. His tunnel vision sometimes, where he just kind of gets away from the game plan and does his own thing. Like, there are all sorts of little tiny issues with Domi that don't overshadow what a talented offensive player he is, but not a great D-zone player. So if you want to play him at center, you need to play him with a defensively responsible winger. He requires a lot of moving around of pieces in order to accommodate him.
Yeah. And we used to say that about Jonathan Drouin.
Yeah. Yeah. And that still might be true of Jonathan Drouin. He had a good 20 odd games, but but that is a problem with Jonathan Drouin, is that it was impossible to find compatible line mates with him. It's not impossible to find compatible line mates for Max Domi, because the Canadiens are blessed to have a player like Arturi Lehkonen. But what it means is that Arturi Lehkonen has to be tied essentially to Max Domi, or a similarly responsible forward needs to be tied. It wasn't the case last night, actually, though. That was interesting to see Claude Julien kind of load up line offensively, you know, and have
Kovalchuk and Jake Evans.
And Jake Evans, yeah. So, and, you know, having Jake Evans in his NHL debut be the defensive conscience of the two other guys. But anyhow, it's I agree that if Domi can't move over to the wing, he becomes a bit of a redundant piece for the Canadiens, because Nick Suzuki's not only made it clear to management, but he's clearly won over Claude Julien in the sense that he is a more valuable center than Max Domi is now as a rookie, because he's able to play defensively and it just plays a more responsible game than Max Domi does, and is frankly borderline more productive than he is, and more offensively effective. I don't know if he's more offensively gifted necessarily, but he makes proper decisions. I think he plays a smarter offensive game than Max Domi does on many occasions. So that being the case, I agree. But again, is you also have to ask, is signing Tatar from ages 30 to 34 at minimum, but probably 35 or 36 as a UFA, is that the smartest course of action? I don't know if it is.
Well, recent history has shown that signing guys over 30 is never the right course of action.
Yeah.
So it's always a risky proposition. So they'll, you know, and further to that, I mean, Tatar's value is never going to be higher than that. You have to look also at what's out there on the market. If the best player available right now is Chris Kreider, and even the Rangers, they're still considering possibly re-signing him. It's not a given that he's going to be traded. But you put Tatar out there, and he rivals Kreider as the best forward available on the market. He gives you Kostyrynenko for another year, the peak production, decent salary. He's got a lot of things going for him. So if the Canadiens, they have to make a choice, because if they choose to just drag this along, if they choose to move him in the summer, they won't get quite as much, because it'll become like a long rental.
Well, they might. You never know, though. I mean, we thought the same thing about Max Pacioretty.
Exactly. Yeah, I was about to say that as a caveat. They prove it was an astute trade from Bergevin, that one. But I would be, that being said, I'd be surprised if both Tatar and Domi would start the season in Montreal in the fall. I think that one of the two will be on the move.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, the thing is, there's no urgency with Domi to do anything. You know, I mean, Domi's situation is he's arbitration eligible. So there's no chance of losing Domi for nothing yet. Nor is there a chance of losing Tatar for nothing yet. However, the timeline on losing Tatar for nothing is imminent. It's getting to the point where...
Yeah, but yes and no. Because let's say he stays with the Canadiens for another year. And the Canadiens, crumble at the next season too. And their position of being sellers, they're still going to be able to get something for him.
The only reason you would keep him isn't because you believe you're a competitive team. So, I mean, thinking in those terms... is defeatist. I mean, it doesn't jive with the reason why you're keeping him to begin with. You're keeping him because you believe you're going to be a competitive playoff team, which means that you're going to hit next year's deadline and ostensibly become buyers and not sellers. So if that's the mindset, you can't keep him saying, "Well, if we suck next year, we'll just sell him at the deadline." No.
Keeping him is part of
a plan to be good.
Not only next year, you keep him because you think that you're going to resign
him. You're going to resign him, exactly. So if you've already made the determination that you're not going to resign him, it's not as if the Canadiens can realistically hope to win the Stanley Cup next year. If they were in a position like that, I would say, sure, keep him, let him walk, fine. Keep him for the year. But the Canadiens aren't in that position, so there's some asset management that needs to go on. And frankly, I agree with everything you said about Domi too, but it's not outside the realm of possibility, I think, that they use even both of them to go out and fill other holes on the team, you know, and they could make a whole series of moves, because if they traded both of them, they would be weak at the wing suddenly. Like that suddenly their surplus would be a deficit. So they would have to maybe have some corresponding moves to get another winger or what have you, but it just seems to me like what my gut feeling is that neither of these questions are going to be dealt with at the deadline. Mm-hmm. So you know, that's what all this comes down to. Even though Tatar's added the second playoff run with Tatar should add to his value, I don't know if a market's really going to shape up where the Canadiens are going to get what they want in a deal like this. But if you make him available at the draft and you make Domi available at the draft and you get a true bidding war involved, teams that hope to make the playoffs next year, teams that have needs at that position, teams that wouldn't necessarily be in the buyer's market at the deadline, then maybe you can get something closer to what you're looking for in terms of a price.
Right. So, okay. So if Tatar is unlikely to be traded at this trade deadline, same, how about Petrie? Actually, it's even more true for Petrie, because if they chose to trade Tatar, they could find in-house some replacements on the wing. Whereas on defense, where they've been struggling with depth, they would have no one in the short term, not even next year, but maybe even the year after that, to replace Petrie on the right side. And just right now, in very short term, with Shea Weber being out, you have the clear example of why Jeff Petrie is so important to this team.
Not only that, but... You look at the moves the Canadiens made prior to the Ducks game. So they had a question mark about Mete. They had a question mark about Poehling. They had a question mark about Tatar. So they were all sick and didn't know who would play. Ultimately, Poehling did not. Mete did, and Tatar did. But because Mete was in the mix, they called up one forward, Jake Evans, and one defenseman. And if Poehling and Tatar didn't go, the Canadiens might have been forced to play seven defensemen. The seventh defenseman being Xavier Ouellette. The guy they did not call up is Josh Brook, because Josh Brook is not there yet. And the belief might have been, as recently as training camp, or just heading into training camp, that maybe by next season, Josh Brook could be ready to fill a role in the top six. And I think what this season has shown is that he is not. The other guy who was not called back was Cale Fleury. Cale Fleury has not been great in the two games he played in Laval. I watched both games. He was not fantastic. He made mistakes. He did not seem like a guy who was too good for the AHL and was screaming for a call up. Neither was Xavier Ouellette, mind you. But the point being that they called up Xavier Ouellette, and Claude Julien said it in very blunt terms. He said he was called up on merit. And this was not just let's do a solid tour captain down in Laval kind of thing. He was the best candidate they had identified to come up and play. which to me says a lot about the two right-handed defensemen who were there, because the problem was Shea Weber being out, a right-handed defenseman. They called up a left-handed defenseman.
Yeah.
And so Josh Brooks, in all likelihood, not that close to playing anywhere near the role that Jeff Petrie plays. Cale Fleury, same deal. They'll probably be competing for a third pairing job next year in camp. And there's nothing else in the system. Alexander Romanov's probably going to be playing in Montreal next season. Penciling him in for anything more than a third pairing left side gig would not be prudent, would not make any sense, because he doesn't play top 4 minutes in the KHL right now, and he's never done it. So there's nothing in the near future that could replace Jeff Petrie. And if this team wants to compete, they can't lose him. So as ridiculous as this might sound, and having said that they shouldn't sign Tomáš Tatar at age 30, signing Jeff Petrie at age, 33? He'll be 34 by the time his contract expires, I think.
I think he'll be 34.
Yeah. So I think signing him on a shorter-term deal, if he agrees to that, makes some sense.
Yeah, because it's funny because the hockey teams are so allergic to older players now that when you reach a certain age, there's a tipping point where deals start getting shorter.
Right.
So, and I think that Petrie will be entering that window. He can't look for a 6-year contract at his age, you know?
No.
If the Canadiens can have him for 2 years, maybe three, it could be okay. I don't think that it would hurt them at all. The foundation of his game is skating, and I don't see his skating declining anytime soon.
No, and even if it did a little bit, you know, he could adjust his game. Maybe he won't be as prolific an offensive player, which it should be noted that he's on his way to another career high season. It would be his fourth in a row. Fourth year in a row, setting a new career high in points. And just to clarify, Petrie would technically be 33 at that time, but he would be turning 34 in December after that contract kicked in. So yeah, you'd be signing him essentially for his age 34 to 36 or 30, even maybe even 37 seasons, but probably 34, 36. And it's just because of the dynamic. You know, in Tatar's case, there's a lot of hopeful things that could happen. You know, Jesse Ullinen could come from Finland and transition well to the NHL and become a viable top 9 winger within 2 years. Cole Caulfield could come to the NHL and play as soon as this March. But
who knows?
Who knows? But perhaps next season becomes another factor on the wing. You know, the Canadiens have to make decisions this year on offering entry-level contracts to Cam Hillis, Alan McShane, Samuel Udd, and Cole Fonstad. Is it realistic for any of those players to be an NHL player within the next year? No.
No.
No, absolutely not. But, you know, the thing about this whole reset thing and the thing about having all these draft picks is that guys like that need to pan out for this whole thing to work. They need to find a guy like Alan McShane and have him blossom into this good NHL player. They need one guy.
A later pick that becomes an impact
player. And it hasn't happened with this team. You know, Mete, it happened, Gallagher, it happened, but there's only so long. I feel like the Gallagher-Mete picks are somewhat, mainly the Gallagher pick is leaned on to the same extent that like Detroit's European scouting was long vaunted because they found Henrik Zetterberg and Pavel Datsyuk and you know it they didn't do a whole lot other than that, you know, and they got Holmstrom and they had, you know, Franzen and they had some guys, but eventually they stopped drafting those guys and they were just going on reputation, and the Canadiens need to, you know, Trevor Timmins has never had an influx. We've never had an influx this large of Trevor Timmins drafted players in his whole career. In a 3-year span, the Canadiens are going to add like 35 prospects to the system by the time this draft comes up. It's actually, assuming they have 11 picks this year, it will be exactly 35 prospects in 3 years.
There needs to be a home run in there.
There needs to be something. There needs to be a home run or two or three solid doubles, you know, from the later rounds. And All this to say that these guys, many of the potential replacements on the wing or at forward are in the system already. They've been drafted. So now it's a question of marinating them and hoping one comes out perfectly seasoned and ready to play in the NHL. But the Canes don't have that same bank on defense, even though they drafted a whole bunch. And they do have some promising guys, Jordan Harris and Jaden Struble at Northeastern and Norlander you mentioned earlier. But it seems further down the road than it does at forward. So that kind of makes Petrie's situation, I think, pretty markedly different from Tatar's.
Yeah. So Petrie, not traded, stays here, replaces. It takes a lot of Weber's additional responsibilities, so he'll play a ton in the foreseeable future. But there's another defenseman whose contract expires, and that's Marco Scandella. I was thinking that with Weber being out for the next little while, that he would be a defenseman that would get additional responsibilities too. That could maybe, you know how the Canadians have had like a top three on defense since the beginning of the season with Weber, Petrie, and Ben Chiarot. I thought that he would be probably the one sliding in to become that new number three defenseman. But judging by the game against
Anaheim. Or give them a proper top four.
Yes, kind of. Yeah. Exactly. But judging by the game against Anaheim, it hasn't been the case. I mean, Kulak is back in the coach's good graces, whereas
on merit he's been legitimately good.
Absolutely, Scandella's played with 13 minutes last night. Mm-hmm. So at a time where the Canadians are hoping probably to get good value or get something interesting in return for a defenseman that in the past has proven that he could play a top four role if demanded, it's a bit disappointing that. You know, it's only one game, but that he hasn't had that opportunity to really showcase himself. And you know, using Weber not being there to play more. Right.
I think the one thing with Scandella that's worth mentioning is you know, Claude Julien has cryptically sort of referenced his health and that he's banged up. He's playing banged up, so that might be a reason why they have. Because when healthy. He's shown good things, you know. Yes. He's been a good defenseman. I don't think he's healthy right now, and so that's an issue. But you know, the Canadians spent a fourth round pick to get him. You would have to think they could at least get a fourth round pick back.
Yes,
at the deadline
for sure.
This is also a case where the Canadians. This is a position of need. He's a left defenseman. And they're not swimming in left defensemen who can play, who have shown the ability to play 17 to 19 minutes a game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kulak's doing it right now. He played 19 minutes against the Ducks, but he's also been scratched. He's not exactly a proven, guaranteed commodity in that sense. Mete, same deal. So behind Chiarot, And don't tell me Romanov, because we don't know if he can do that, because he hasn't done it in the KHL yet. So to say he can do it in the NHL is ludicrous. He will one day, I'm sure of it. He's a talented guy, but next year, I don't think so. So they're sitting with this guy, Marco Scandella, makes $4 million a year, is from Montreal, from NDG, in fact, where we are recording this podcast. and
he's so happy to be
in Montreal. And I think... I would have to think reality has set in for... He can't be expecting a raise on this contract. Like, at $4 million a year, I don't think he's getting a raise. I think he's getting a pay cut.
No doubt.
For him to stay in Montreal, he would have to take a rather significant pay cut.
Yes.
Like, somewhere to the tune of, like, $2.5 million a year. Would he be willing to do that? Perhaps. And should the Canadians have that conversation with him? Perhaps. So it's even in his case, it's not cut and dry, easy. Oh, just trade the impending UFA. We have no intention of keeping him because, frankly. But then again, the Canadians maybe will say, you know, we learned our lesson with Kulak, where we signed him to a 3-year deal. Maybe if we had to do it again, maybe we wouldn't have done that. We were basing it on one season. I think Scandella has far more of a track record than Kulak did, but still, he does address a need for this team short term.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think the Canadians should maybe consider, that maybe they should sign him to a 1 or 2 year deal and see if he would accept that as a UFA. His one shot, really, at a true UFA, sort of, you know, late 20s UFA. You don't get that shot. He's not going to have another shot at UFA where he'll be super valuable in his 30s. You know, like this is... So if he's willing to take a shorter term deal at a pay cut, I have no sense that he is willing to do that. But if he is, the Canadians need to find that out, I would think. And then it should factor into their decision of what to do.
Right. Well, I think regarding the trade deadline, the teams are always looking for defensemen at the deadline. And if the Canadians were only able to get him for a fourth round pick early in the year, I think that there are two factors at play in. The first one was that Scandella was so bad last season in Buffalo that it sort of tainted the perception on him, similar to the way that the perception towards Tomas Tatar was tainted by his short stint in Vegas, where it proved to be the outlier more than the norm, you know, regarding Tatar. So, because he started very well in Buffalo this season under Coach Kruger, and then was traded to Montreal, proved to be a perfectly decent and serviceable defenseman. And the other factor was the price to pay. For many teams that are pushed close to the cap, trying to find creative ways to stay under the cap, they just could not afford to add a $4 million defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
at that time of year.
At that time of the year.
Yeah.
So there was less of a market. So the Canadians used the fact that they had that cap flexibility to go after him and get him for just a fourth round pick. That's why I think that at this time of the year, you could turn around and get much better for him than a fourth round pick, certainly a third round, because of, you know, I told you earlier about retaining salary, about the fact that there's less. There's less money to be paid to the players, so more teams will be able to afford him. I think he's an interesting commodity. And for all the talk about Kovalchuk possibly being traded and circling back in the summer and say, hey, could we trade you and you come back on July 1st? I would see that a lot more of a possibility with Scandella than with Kovalchuk.
Yes, absolutely. And... you know, in Scandella's case, it's important to note that how much he has loved being here, and there's not going to be a ton of UFA defensemen on the market.
No, it's everybody. Really, people talk about Dylan DeMello as being like probably the best target on defense.
Exactly. So in that market, Scandella could probably, if he so chose, maybe carve out a good contract for himself. So, you know, it is something to consider. I think what you said is correct, that they could probably trade him and then approach him for a contract. And I think that it's possible that Scandella would consider coming here because he's loved it so much. We get to see, you know, where we work in like what's essentially sort of a cafeteria for when there's concerts at the Bell Center is where we work after games. And we kept often seeing the entire Scandella family walking through there and just like super happy with how life has turned out. And that's a factor, you know, that's a factor for these guys. And he's just been all smiles since he's been here. So maybe they could trade him and maybe they could have their cake and eat it too. But you know, I think we're going to cut it there. Cause I think we've made our point that in the sense that the Canadians are facing some very, very complicated and delicate decisions ahead of the deadline. They can't be a pure seller. I mean, the one guy we didn't mention is Nate Thompson. I'd be stunned if he was here after February 24th. He's another type of guy that teams are always looking for. And I hope he gets traded to a Stanley Cup contender and then he wins the Stanley Cup. I would really like that. So yeah. I hope that happens. But, you know, that's kind of our rundown on trade deadline. A lot of these things for our subscribers might sound a bit familiar because we've written about this topic and we've written about these guys. But if you're not a subscriber, just to remind you that if you want to read stuff like this, we're going to be pumping out trade deadline content all month. leading up to the deadline, coming out of the deadline, and analyzing what the Canadiens should do between then and the season, off season, preseason, training camp. It's always on our minds, Canadiens all the time. If you want to get in on that, you can get a discount just for listening to this podcast. You can go to theathletic.com/athletic support. Get 40% off your first year at The Athletic, where you get all of our Canadiens coverage. You get all our NHL coverage. We have a writer covering every single team and all MLB, NFL, NBA, and everything else. So theathletic.com/athletic support.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. And Athletic subscribers, we're going to see you, or you're going to hear from us, on Monday. Bye-bye, everybody. Enjoy the snow.